Bon matin tout le monde, bienvenue à la deuxième édition d'Une tasse de thé avec Max Salon. Tellement content de vous avoir avec nous autres ce matin en direct de la terrasse du centre de golf Le Versant. Merci d'être là, merci d'avoir participé en si grand nombre à la première émission hier. Je veux remercier Juan Benson, je veux remercier Julien Trudeau qui ont été tellement généreux. L'édition Caddyshack hier a été tellement cool de pouvoir parler un peu de ce travail-là de Caddy, aussi du travail de ces gars-là dans leur vie de tous les jours, évidemment. Julien Caddy pour Adam Long, Johan Pro à Laval-sur-le-Lac, golfeur professionnel, ancien Caddy. C'était vraiment un moment extraordinaire hier. Plus de 5000 personnes se sont branchées pour écouter la première émission hier d'Une tasse de thé. On vous en remercie du plus profond de notre cœur. C'est vraiment cool. La table de concertation de l'industrie du golf du Québec a voulu mettre ça en place pour créer du contenu, pour qu'on vous parle de golf, pour qu'on vienne le matin comme ça, la fin de semaine, avec une tasse de thé, avec un café, venir vous jaser. Il y a vraiment des thés dedans. Venir vous jaser du sport qu'on aime tant. Je veux les saluer, l'Association des clubs de golf du Québec, la CGQ, l'Association des surintendants de golf du Québec, la PGA du Québec, Golf Québec et l'Association nationale des propriétaires de terrains de golf du Canada, Section Québec. Ça, c'est la table de concertation. Ce sont les gens qui, à chaque jour, travaillent tellement, tellement fort pour vous donner une saison de golf 2020 qui, malgré tout ce qu'on vit présentement, sera mémorable. On est content d'être là. Aujourd'hui, c'est une émission spéciale. L'entrevue va se faire en anglais dans les prochaines minutes. J'espère que vous serez en mesure de tout comprendre. Sinon, lors des moments opportuns, je vais tenter de traduire du mieux que je peux pour vous. Avant de vous présenter l'invité de ce matin, je veux vous saluer, peu importe de où vous êtes au Québec. Je veux vous dire merci d'être là. Et je veux vous poser la question du jour et je vais vous inviter à répondre en commentaire. Je vous invite à répondre en commentaire. C'est une question qui va être à deux volets, le volet québécois et le volet international. Mettons là, qu'en 2020, cette année, là, pour la saison de golf 2020, vous avez le droit de jouer seulement une partie de golf. Vous avez le droit d'en jouer une partout dans le monde où vous voulez. Vous avez le droit d'en jouer une au Québec. Je veux vos deux terrains. Quel terrain, mettons? On fabule. Mettons qu'on a le droit de voyager puis que cette affaire-là, ça va jamais arriver, qu'on peut aller où on veut puis on rêve. Vous jouez deux parties, une à l'international, une au Québec. Quels sont vos deux terrains? Je veux ça en commentaire, vos réponses. Je vais aller jouer à l'écran. Si jamais vous avez des questions également pour mon invité d'aujourd'hui, vous pourrez comme ça les mettre à l'écran. Vous le voyez à l'écran. I'm going to switch to English right now to introduce him properly. He has been a professional golfer for so many years now. Not saying that he's old, but he has some experience, you know? And you've seen him in Quebec at the Championnat de Québec in 2014. He played in the Ryder Cup 3 times. He finished 2nd at the Masters. He has 4 pro wins on the PGA Tour. It's a very big and great honor for me this morning to have, via internet from his home in Florida, Mr. Chip Beck. Mr. Beck, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. I love watching you. You talk with your hands. I love that.
Yeah.
You have gloves on.
I know. It's a bit chilly here, you know, in Montreal. Montreal and Florida, it's not the same weather. It's still a little bit cold here.
Yeah, I haven't worn a sweater in like 3 months in Florida. I'm near Naples. Oh, man, it's warm down here.
Oh, I know, but how's the weather? Not that much rain in Florida, right?
We've had one, maybe 2 days of rain in 3 months. It hardly ever rains. Where I am, it's like a desert, really. They get all their rain in like July and August.
Wow, and what part of Florida are you in?
I'm on the West Coast in Naples. It's really beautiful down here. A lot of Canadians come down here, too.
Yeah, a lot of Canadians, a lot of people from Quebec, they love Florida. You know, we love Florida because we're trying to escape winter. We're trying to escape snow. And it's something that we, when you can do it and you can run away from snow and play golf 12 months a year, it's a thing that we love to do.
There's no doubt about it. And the Canadians are very hardy. They like to play. It doesn't matter if it's raining or not. Or if it's,
oh, I know.
If it's
know.
40 degrees and the wind blowing 25, they think it's great. It's like, wow.
I know. We just love golf so much. We're ready to put a couple of fleeces on so we can just go out and play. And it's we have that relationship with that sport where it's fun to play with the sun when it's 90 degrees and everything. But we can play because it's funny because I was doing some research and going through your career. And I saw a photo of you back in 2014 in Quebec hitting a ball in the snow for the press conference at Golf La Tempête. Was it a first time for you hitting a golf ball in the snow?
That was the first time I'd been in weather 20 below.
Really?
And the wet and the snow was like so fluffy. The ball from in my bin in my pocket would sink like 6 inches. So I had to kind of build it up. But man, Andre and Carol Ramon, we had so much fun there. I'll never forget it. They had the head of all Canadian transportation. They had the city council. They had the mayor. They had everybody from Quebec City. And I was there and I was going to hand out like an award for it. Like my wife had invented this grip guide and I was going to give a couple away. And I was looking up the history and trying to come up with a good Q&A, you know, so if they got the answer correct, I'd give them a grip guide. Well, I'm telling you, what was amazing is they were so nice to me. And I realized I didn't know the culture, the history, the language. And so I went home and I started researching all Canadian history. And one of the great things of my life, the CBC did a series of videos in the year 2000. It took about 2.5 years to put across the nation.
Yeah.
And it was called The History of a People, Canada. And they had this beautiful theme song. And there was a lady named Maggie Hugelack, who was a famous Canadian actress. Her voice, it was so good. They were about an hour and 50 minutes long. And I used to, in the winter, I would get on my treadmill and listen to the history of a people. It started like 600 years before the nation was founded in 1867 and went all the way to, you know, almost 2000. It was the most beautiful film. I thought every American should see it and every Canadian should see it. And everybody.
A little bit more about the culture.
Oh, pardon me?
Just to know a little bit more about our culture in Canada and in Quebec. And if you travel a little bit, you'll find out that Canada as a culture, but Quebec as a culture as well. And it's sometimes very different. And especially the city of Quebec, which is beautiful. And I know that you liked a lot.
Canadians, believe it or not, the Canadians went up against the Americans in 4 different wars.
Yeah.
And a lot of my Canadian buddies don't even know about it. And you've never lost. You've never lost. You've always beat the Americans. And I find it, we're so fortunate to have such great neighbors. I'm telling you, it's really wonderful. But Quebec City is my favorite place. We were planning to come this summer with my whole family.
Really?
Yeah, to take a vacation. We were coming up there. La Tempête was opening up a whole new golf course. We're going to have a grand opening. It was going to be spectacular. And, this Cronova, I don't know what in the world, but I know the Ramones were very upset about that. So was I. We were going to have a vacation and a celebration.
I know, but Andre and Carol, they're so welcoming and they love people so much. I know I'm friends with their son, Frederick, at La Tempête, and he's such a nice guy. And every time they make friends with somebody, they keep that relationship. And it's fun to see that you've been in Quebec for the Championship of Quebec. You still keep relationship with those people. It's fun to see that friendship has been built over the years.
Yeah, and they all, like you say, they do maintain good relationships. And I think they have the friendliest course I've ever been to. They're always welcoming. Oh, for sure.
And what do you think of the course?
I mean, their restaurant there, the Monte Cristo, they've got a big bar. It's beautiful. It's so welcoming and so kind. I'm so glad to have their friendship, and I look forward to being involved with them. You know,
I'm just putting Carol on the screen right now. Carol is saying, you're still welcome this summer, Chip.
Okay. Thank you. My wife was saying, please invite us. We can't wait to come back. We want to come back.
Did you ever came back to Quebec since 2014? You've never been here after that?
Well, I played their championship, the Quebec championship.
Yeah, I know. But after that, like since 2014, did you came back to Quebec once or you never came back after 2014?
I think I came one time after that. And, I just love the area. But we were really planning to have a great, spend about 3 weeks up in Quebec this summer. And my whole family, we're going to bring them all because, you know, the whole on the St. Lawrence Seaway, they're so beautiful. The city it's definitely top 3 most beautiful cities in the world. I've been to Cape Town.
Wow.
It's up there with Cape Town. I don't know of a prettier city than Cape Town and Quebec City. It's really... I've been to a lot of places too.
Yeah, and at that time, that tournament was so important for the city of Quebec because this tournament was in Montreal for about, I think, 6 years, and it moved to Quebec, and it dragged so many people, and it was on the news everywhere, on TV everywhere. There was some big names, you, a couple of other players there. It looked like it's been an amazing experience for every player that walked at La Tempête in 2014.
Yeah, almost broke the course record there. I think Frederick might have had it. So it's like, oh,
65, man. I think.
What was it?
You played 65, I think, right?
Yeah. So I think Frederick had shot a low score and some other guys, but it's like, oh, man. But what was really interesting about that tournament, I played a really good round the first day, and then the rains came and softened the course up.
Yeah.
And I was hitting four irons the first day. The next day I was hitting three woods. It was like, wow, it was too long. I shot 75 the next day, and I think I played better.
I know. And the thing about La Tempête is you can get excited very quick about your play, because with all the par fives, with all the layout, and all of a sudden, if the rain comes in, if the wind comes in, it's a brand new course and brand new conditions to play in.
It's always in great shape, though. That's what I love about crazy. It. It's absolutely the lake vistas are beautiful, and I think it's a great experience. I really enjoy it. I mean, it's a truly international club. So I look forward, you know, they're building a new course. They put $10 to $15 million in a new course. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, and you know, when you look at the layout of La Tempête, you're saying, can they top that? Can they do better than what they already did with the course number one? Everybody's excited about that because we're all wondering what the course is going to be. We saw the lookouts on paper, but like, you know, golf course on paper and a golf course walking it, it's not the same thing. You can see pictures of Pebble Beach, but if you walk on Pebble Beach or if you play Pebble, you don't get a feeling until you walk on it.
Well, I really love the flyovers now that they have at the golf courses. Those are really a lot. They're pretty interesting.
You were talking about course records. We call you Mr. 59. You're one of the few players in the world that played 59 in a pro golf tournament back in the 90s in Las Vegas. How often do people refer to you as Mr. 59 or talk to you about that particular round?
One of the nicest things that's happened, a couple of things. They gave me $1 million, and I donated it to the Western Golf Association. We put about 48 kids through college with that all throughout the U.S., mostly in the Midwest. And, you know, every time somebody shoots a 59, whether it's Annika Sorenstam, they always bring up my name and put my name on television. I shot mine in 1991.
Yeah, you were the second player to shot 59.
Yeah, so it kind of kept me in current with all the young people coming up, which was, it kept my name out there. So it's been really nice for me. People remember me that now about, oh, he's Mr. 59. So it's kind of nice.
Yeah, I know. But yes, Mr. 59, but you've won four tournaments. You've competed in three Ryder Cups. You finished second at the Masters in 90. You got so many other things on the board other than playing 59. And that number is so it's so big in the mind of golfers that's what puts this info on top, I think.
But Max, let me tell you something. Jim Furyk shot 58 and a 59 in the same year. I thought that was the end of it. So, I mean, it's really surprising. But let me tell you, one of the greatest things that happened in Canadian history is they've saved Glen Abbey.
Yeah,
I thought Glen Abbey was one of the hardest golf courses I'd ever played.
It is.
When you go, you know, 11 to 15, all in that valley stretch down there, and you come up by those rivers, we were hitting such long irons into those, like, all those par fours. It was really a hard golf course. And at that time, it was the third most prestigious tournament after the U.S. Open, the British Open, in the world. Because I remember Lee Trevino winning when I was a kid, you know, and it was like the Triple Crown almost. And Nicklaus never won it. It's like, this is a tournament. Palmer won it, you know, his first tournament. And I always wanted to win the Canadian Open. And I was really so glad they saved Glen Abbey. That meant a lot to me because that was a great golf course. And it's just good for Canadian golf and golf in general.
Yeah, it's great. Last year, Rory won the tournament in Hamilton. But the fun thing about that tournament is everybody talks about it, and it's the great and the big tournament in Canada. And you were talking about Trevino. They brought back Trevino for the press conference a couple of years ago to say, hey, we're getting big. And the new place and the calendar for that tournament is better for the guys to like where it's at in the calendar to go and sign up for the tournament. Because, you know, some of the guys right now on the schedule, I think that they just – they don't play 40 tournaments a year. They step down for a couple of tournaments, and they got a couple of big names, Dustin Johnson playing it, Rory playing it. So it's amazing for golf in Canada. And the thing about Golf Canada and Lawrence Applebaum and their team and everybody there, they're trying to throw a Canadian party around the tournament. So they do music shows in the parking lot at night after tournament. So it's something other than just a golf tournament. It's an experience that they build it up right there.
Yeah, and Keith Urban was supposed to be there this year. So it was going to be a big party. I know that. Maybe they'll come to Quebec at La Tempête. You know, that'd be the RBC at La Tempête. They've got a lot of land. It's a great city. People would really enjoy it, you know.
That would be amazing. But the only thing I remember about the first thing that comes to my mind about the Canadian Open is Tiger Woods' bunker shot in 2000 on 18. It's just I played Glen Abbey and I dropped the ball at the exact same place the Tiger hit a shot, and I took out my 6-iron like he had, and I'm like, how can you do that? You guys are so good at that. And it's, you know,
Max, I was doing television that week up there.
Yeah.
And I was walking to the left side of the 18th fairway. Grant Wade had just hit it on the left side of the green. Beautiful shot. And Tiger is standing there, and the drops of rain are starting to come down as they hit you, and it was so cold. It was like, bam, bam, big drops. And then, you know, a couple inches, like, oh, this is getting cold here, you know, and the wind was kicking up. I was shocked. I said, oh no, he's missed it. He's hit it, pushed it way right. That was definitely one of the greatest shots in the history of the game. I never dreamed anybody would go under those conditions to that flag. I think Grant Waite, I've talked to him since, and he's like, it was shocking. He thought he put it right of the green in the water. It was like, that was a miracle shot. I mean, just the distance he hit it.
I know. It's six. Yeah, he had a 6-iron, and I think the distance was like 204, 205 in the bunker. You know, one thing that amazed me about golf is when you get a tournament with a bunch of people, with thousands of people, you get Tiger hitting a shot or any pro golfer hitting a shot, and you can hear the silence during the ball being in the air and nobody speaking, everybody wondering, is the ball gonna make it? And this is like the crazy 9-10 seconds and that intense moment where it can change the purpose of a tournament right there.
That was the greatest 6-iron ever hit in a tour event anywhere in the world. And you know, Mickelson at the Masters was another great 6-iron.
Yeah.
When he won the tournament 2010 or whatever. But that was the greatest shot I've ever seen. And I played a lot of golf. I was shocked by that shot. Well, especially because the rain was coming. And it was, you know, it was hitting him, splatting him on the back. Pop, 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 pop. It was like, wow, it was such a heightened moment of awareness. Like you're saying, people were like, oh, my goodness, this is going to be incredible. And the wind was swirling. It was a miracle shot. It was fascinating to see it, you know, that good.
It's not in his character, but Tiger could have laid up there, but he had to go to the green. And I don't want to bring up bad memories, but in the Masters in 93, when you finished second on 15, you laid up. And you inspired the writers of the movie Tin Cup.
Did I really?
Yeah. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. But
you didn't know that? I was reading on a website about the plot of Tin Cup, and the thing they were saying is that they were trying to find an angle for Costner's character to be attractive. And they were watching the Masters that year and seeing you lay up on 15, being backed by Tria at Langer, the writers, they just said, all right, my character, Tin Cup, he is not going to lay up. He's going to go until he gets to the green. I was sure he knew about that.
I didn't. I thought that was a joke, you know, but I'll tell you right now, I got grilled on that one. But, you know, I had a new three wood in the bag that week. They had these mounds on the right side of the fairway, and I happened to be right behind a mound. So I had to shoot the ball straight up into the air. I was 10 yards behind my go point.
Yeah.
And the wind was blowing 25 miles an hour. Now, the kicker was it was 250 to the front of the green, which is a long carry. I was carrying it 240 at the time.
Yeah.
But the bunker on the right is 10 yards shorter. And I thought, well, I could skirt the mound in front of me and catch that bunker if the flag were, like, they put it 3 feet on the front edge, literally.
Yeah.
One step, the flag could be on the front edge. But it was 30 feet back. It was like an open flag. So I thought, well, it's crazy to risk the whole tournament on one shot when, you know, I can hold it from the fairway. And sure enough, a guy in front of me actually had hold it, you know, a wedge into the flag. Because, you know, if the flag is down front, it's almost impossible to make a four. And then I was also thinking about, you know, where the flags were finishing and how I figured if I made birdie there, maybe picked up a couple coming in, I could get the playoff. And you know what was really amazing? Ray Floyd came to me and he said, Chip, you did the right thing. And Nicholas told me that too. But Ray said, Chip, I was in the same position the year before, wow, three shots back, and I, you know, trying to get in that playoff. And he lost to Nick Faldo that year. But he said, you know, you can't risk it on one shot, especially, you know, I mean, you got to play your game, you know.
I know.
So anyway, Venturi got me on that one. I'll tell you, he grilled me.
And, you know, we got a bunch of people watching right now from all over Quebec. And you're talking about a pro tournament and the Masters and thinking about that. And we do the same thing when we're playing as amateurs on any clubs. And we're playing with our buddies for $20. And I'm wondering, it's taking 5 minutes in my mind whether to decide if I'm going to go for the green or whether I'm going to lay up. And I'm only playing for – I just can't imagine the amount of stress coming in being at the Masters, the greatest tournament of golf, and having to take that decision knowing that if you win the Masters, it changes your life.
You know, I played the Masters about 13 times, and I never came around Amen Corner with a chance to win. Because that golf course, I hit a low fade. And I had, it's like Lee Trevino, no chance. Hale Irwin, no chance. I think he might have had one top 10 there. When you hit a fade, that golf course doesn't open up to you unless you're left-handed like Mike Weir. He can do it, right?
Yeah.
But if you're my size, you have to hit a hook and a big, strong hook. And that year, Hank Haney had taught me how to hit an open-face draw. So you have the face open because all the good drawers have an open face.
Yeah.
So the ball always starts to the right. If it can start 20 yards right, but if it starts a half degree left, you're in Ray's Creek all the way down Amen Corner. So I had that club open back, and I was rolling it and hitting a 25-yard hook. It was a miracle to see. I mean, I practiced for a month beforehand trying to hit a big hook. And I had a chance to win, and literally it was nip and tuck. You know, Langer from the right side of 11, he hits a shot that's hooking across the green. He's begging it to stop. It stops about 6 inches from going into water. And then on 12, he hits it. He misses the green to the right, chips up, makes a 10-footer, and I miss about a 4-footer. I thought it was going to go pretty straight, and it went right. And then, because I thought it would actually go towards Rage Creek, and I missed. So, and then the next hole, what really did it was the 14th hole hit my forward right over the flag, right over the flag. He did the same thing, knocked it right over the flag. So I had to putt first. He's just inside of my ball. My ball got down to the hole about 6 inches from the hole and broke 2 inches left. And he made his. That was the tournament. So it could have been, gone my way, you know.
I know.
So, and I enjoyed that, though. And I think that's the thing that made it. I was so happy when I finished that tournament because I thought, I can win this tournament. I know how to play this tournament now. And that made me so happy because it was a lifetime of trying to figure out how to play the tournament. I used to spin the ball so much and hit the ball fairly high when I first did my first Masters in like 83. I'd hit the ball at the back of the 9 green because it rained my first two Masters. I'd hit the ball on the very back of the green, it'd come all the way down off the front of the green. And then the next year I was thinking, well, I remember reading in, when I was a kid that Hogan, when the flag was on the middle tier and to the left, you could hit it 10 feet left of the flag and the ball would sit there. And I said, it came to my mind. It popped up. I said, I'm going to take this 8-iron and hit it to the left. I hit it. I thought it was perfect. Boom. I said, gosh, that's got to be so good. Just a little bit left of the flag. I figured he'd sit there. Lo and behold, it took 5 minutes for that ball to get momentum. It started tricking. It came down, and it rolled 40 yards in front of the green. I thought, wow, this is the toughest golf course I've ever seen in my life. I really didn't think I had a chance to ever win there. It was just too tough for me with a fade ball. So anyways, that was a great accomplishment to come out there and get a hook and have a chance to win. So they grilled me, man. It was the most criticism I think I ever received from anybody. It was like, I was pretty shocked about it.
You know, every decision you take on the golf course that turns out like that, you remember all your life, especially in the Masters. Talking about that tournament, it was supposed to be a couple of days ago. Being in the state that we're in right now, we have to wait. The season has been pushed back. Is the Masters in November is going to be still the Masters, you think?
Well, I'm hoping that virus doesn't come back. And if it comes back, there's going to be no football in the United States. And that might help them. I don't know. I don't know if they're going to have crowds or not. But hopefully it won't be too big a conflict. I don't know if they have too many big games that weekend on, you know, competing with football.
Yeah.
That's a big thing for us. We like to get the season over before football because there's so many crazy football fans, you know, in the United States. So probably Canada as well. But
In the States, it's something else. We love football here, but in the States, I remember last year I was hosting a golf tournament that was going around the United States. And on Sunday, we were in San Diego, and it was the final round, I think, of the U.S. Open. So I went to the clubhouse because I wanted to see the final rounds, and it was football on TV in the golf course. And I was like, can you please put golf on the TV? The cards are playing. The cards are playing. Watch it on your phone. I was like, "What, really?"
It can be cool down there in November.
Yeah,
generally it'll be a very comfortable time. November, when I played at the University of Georgia, the weather was always good. But yeah, it could be rainy. I mean,
yeah, I know, and we'll see. And we'll watch until there because the Masters is going to be exciting to see Tiger defending his title this year. There's somebody called Martin watching us. He wants to know, what's your second best score ever?
Well, I've shot a couple 61s on the tour. But it's hard to remember. 61 is a long ways from 59. I never shot a 59 before or since. You know, the lowest score I ever saw other than that was a 60 by the pro that taught me to play golf in North Carolina. Tony Evans was his name, but that's what I said. I'm going to make this putt for Tony is what I was thinking. I'm going to make this putt because I'd already seen a 60. I'd never seen a 59.
But
it's you shoot a lot of low scores when you play professional golf. You have to. And that was one of the nice things. I grew up on a pretty short Donald Ross golf course, and you could shoot some really low scores there. So I got in the habit of shooting good scores. And I think that helped me a lot to play better golf as I got older.
When you're on the road to playing 69 and you know that you're packing up birdies and it can happen, that it may happen, what goes to your mind walking into like 15, 16? What state of mind are you in? What kind of player are you when you know that you're going there? Do you like just you're not looking at the scorecard and trying to play your best golf, or you try to put up a strategy?
Well, the golf course – We played five new tournament courses that week in Las Vegas. It was a five-day tournament. And I'd never seen the course. Didn't get a practice round in. So the night before, John Cook and his caddy Dick Mast and his caddy and my caddy were talking about, man, this course you'd shoot 59 on. And, you know, it was a big thing that year because Hilton was giving $1 million away for the first guy that did it. And so I didn't know the course, and my caddy was so good. I'll tell you how good he was. my caddy, Dave Woosley, still caddying out there. I think he caddied for actually David Hearns for a while, but he's right. such a good caddy that he, you know, like in the Ryder Cup, I'd taken, this was like a week and a half after, 2 weeks after the Ryder Cup at Kiawah Island, where I played well. I was so worn out from the tournament. I took a week off and then went to Las Vegas. And it was kind of funny because Dave said, you know, I'm playing Ian Woosnam. He's the number one player in the world at the time. That's when he drove over the green at the 18th hole at Augusta and hit it like a 9-iron into the green and won Augusta. He was the best player in the world, and he'd been drinking all week. It was a party time for him. And I was thinking to myself, how is this guy going to beat me, man? He's been loaded every night this week. He's just having a blast, you know? And I had to hole it out of the fairway, out of the bunker. I had to do everything to beat this guy. But when I got to the 17th tee after Payne Stewart's hit me on the back, come on, Chip, come on, come on, come on, come on. And I said, Payne, you're killing me. Slow up, you know. But I got to the tee, and Dave says, Chip, you just laid up with your 3-wood 210 yards. It's 209 to the flag. It's your 3-wood. I said, give me that 3-wood. I didn't even think about it. I took that ball, teed it up, cracked it right over the flag, and I had about a 15 or 20 footer for a 2-putt and a win. It was like, well, that's how good my caddy was. So when I went into the 59, not knowing the course, he'd say, Chip, you need to hit it about 240 down the left side, right at that tree. I said, okay. Then you need to keep it just below the flag here, take this club, and I'd hit it there. So I just kind of followed him along. But one thing that I remembered clearly, and when I was playing my worst golf, I was thinking, it came back to me. It was like the 17th hole. I stood up on the tee, and the wind picks up. I'm hitting a cut. The wind's coming up from the right to the left, and I backed off. I said, Dave, I think I need to, one, two, bounce it in the fringe to keep it under the hole. So he said, yeah. So I took my 5-iron, aimed it to the right side. Boom, boom, it kept it under the hole. And I had about a 10-footer that broke about a foot. And, you know, if I'd have kept to my original strategy, it was a 2-tier green, and the flag was just on the lower tier. I'd have been on the upside hitting a 2-foot break, or it would have been impossible. So I saw that picture, and I hit it. And then the next hole, I said, Dave, I don't know if I can keep making these putts. Because back then, when you walked on the green, we had spikes. It would kick up a piece of dirt, and it was a very arid climate. It would get like little rocks, and it was like little landmines all over. So when I got to the shot, I said, Dave, I need to hold this shot. It was a perfect 7-iron. Flag cut right over the flag. I said, the ball's sitting down. I think I'm going to take an 8-iron, hit a little bit firmer. With a little more spin, I might have a chance to keep it at the hole. So when I hit it, I remembered seeing it. Just beautiful. I said, ooh, that ball's spinning perfectly. It came out just right. And I was begging it to go in. And I actually thought it was real, like a kick in. I was hoping it went in. But the way they were clapping, I thought, gosh, this thing's close. And it was on the upside of the hole with two spike marks in my line. And I was playing with three amateurs. They're all passed away now. Can you believe it?
Wow.
But that's how long it's been. But those spike marks, I pulled to the side of the green, and I said, you know, if I can just roll my putt good, it'll hit the first one, knock it into the second, which will knock it into the right side of the hole. So don't get quick and pull it left or I'm out. So give it a chance. So I rolled it. I remember seeing it. I rolled it, hit the first one, hit the second one, boom, caught the right side of the hole. But you play your best golf in your imagination, and that's what that's how you play. You visualize it, and you go. That's when you're going to play your best golf.
And yeah, and the more you go, the more you play, the more you get to know about yourself and what you're going to do and what you're going to be able to do. And I got a very nice question from Michael Pichura. Mr. Beck, can you share some memories of playing college golf at Georgia and how college golf has changed over the years? And also, did you know that Golf Quebec rock star Céleste Dao plays for the Bulldogs right now? We got a very talented girl called Céleste Dao playing for the Bulldogs. She is amazing. You're a 3-time All-American from Georgia NCAA golf. What do you remember from that time playing college golf?
Well, we have a very good golf course down there. It was very tough. And it was one of the best courses in the United States. Davis Love has redone it. It's still a really good golf course. I don't think it's as hard as it was. The ball's going farther. But it's quite an accomplishment for a young Canadian girl to play for the Dogs, because they're always top 10. They've always had a great women's team, just like the men's team. And some of my best friends come from the Lady Dawgs, you know. So Sandy Lumpkin is a great player. You know, she's a great teacher in Arizona. And she's a good friend of mine. I love her brother, whole family. You know, the Lumpkins are big teachers in the United States. But the it's quite an accomplishment. But college golf, really, when I was a sophomore, I won the All-America Tournament in Houston, Texas at this place called Atascocita.
Yeah.
It was a real tight golf course. And the coach that week said, "Chip, all you guys are going to be playing this Hogan golf ball," because it was good in the wind. It was windy and it was pretty tight. And I remember winning that tournament, and that I made like second team All-American that year. That was like the biggest tournament outside the NCAA.
Wow.
And so, yeah, college golf is it's a great stepping stone. And I won like six tournaments, and it was the greatest experience of my life. One of the things that was really nice for me is all their when I came in, they had a whole new team. It was Tim Simpson, Robert Donald, myself, and Jim Becker. I played 4 years straight through. And Jay Haas and Curtis Strange were the number one and two player in the world from Wake Forest at the time. We played them every time we were in a tournament, which was pretty much every tournament. So I got to play with Curtis a lot, Jay a lot. So I grew a lot. And I still remember shots they hit, you know, from that time. It was a great stepping stone and a great if you play well in college, you can definitely – all the guys that I played with then are still playing the tour, played the Champions Tour, whether it's Marco Mira and John Cook. We had tournaments in Japan. I remember, they used to give up – the Fugazi Travel in New York City gave away the All-America tournaments. It was a John Kennedy hit, and that was pretty exciting for a young kid coming from North Carolina. So yeah, college golf's great.
You can get on the spotlight very quick and be in the eye of the media very quick, even being in college golf. I'm taking the example of Matthew Wolf, who became a star in college. And right now, he's a sensation on the PGA Tour. He's won one tournament. He's only 21. So it's a great way to kick it off to be someone on TV in the golf industry.
So one of the things that's really changed, talking about a Matthew Wolf or a Jordan Spieth or Justin Thomas or Ricky Fowler. What's really fascinating in my day, Curtis Strange was our best player. He won the U.S. I don't think he won the U.S. Amateur, but he was the best college player by far. It took him 4 years to get on tour. So my first year, I finished second in the qualifying school in 1978. And just to give you some perspective, it's really kind of interesting because I played really well and qualified. I think John Folt won the tour championship, and he came out and won two tournaments, won his first two tournaments on tour, but didn't like the lifestyle. And so he went into golf course architecture. That was like, wow, this is amazing to have a dream like that and then give it up like John Folt did.
Yeah.
But anyways, I didn't get in a tournament. I got in a tournament in March. Because when I went to Phoenix, there were four golf courses, 150 guys each, one person at each golf course. There might be four players getting in each week. And there were a lot of players trying to qualify every week. So just winning, just finishing, you know, top 25 in the qualifier at the beginning of the year, it gave you a chance to qualify each week. I didn't qualify until July of that year. And I finished 15th in the Western Open. And I made like $1,400. I played pretty well to the end of the year, and I didn't keep my card by like $92, and I didn't even make $7,000. So I went back to the tour school. I finished second again to Jim Thorpe, and then I didn't have to go back until, you know, I pretty much retired after I was in my 40s.
Yeah.
But it was a different – we didn't play for the money. We played for the love of the game, and we thought we were going to – you know, be famous and have a great life of playing competitive golf. We love golf for golf's sake, you know.
And just being able to say that your job is to tour around the world and play golf, this is amazing. And it's a dream life for everybody that loves golf. Everybody is watching us right now would love to be paid to play golf instead of pay $45 to go lose some balls in the woods.
Yeah, and so the young kids today can come right out and get right on tour. The only guy we had do that was like Gary Hallberg. He came out and won $40,000 in the first four tournaments. So he had a full exemption. But there weren't many guys like that. But it's really interesting, though, when you look at DeChambeau.
Yeah.
He's probably one of the most gifted people to come out of college. And I think he's got this rolling of these arms. He's a big, strong kid. But the only two people to come out with his credentials was Ben Crenshaw, who won his first two tournaments, and Jack Nicklaus to win the U.S. Amateur and the NCAA. Crenshaw and Nicklaus are the only two guys since DeChambeau. And, you know, it took him a year and a half to win.
And that's amazing.
In our day, I thought it was a lot harder to win starting out because, you know, you'd have J.C. Sneed and Sam Sneed looking down. Boy, what the heck are you doing? I remember playing with Sam Sneed. I played in 1979 with Sam Sneed at the Quad Cities tournament. And he looked at me, he slapped me. He said, son, keep the ball in your stance. You can't play with the ball outside your toe like that. I mean, they you were like a young punk. But the kids today, I'm playing with Sam Steed and George Archer and Jack Nicklaus, Lee Trevino. I'm playing practice rounds with them. They teach you. I remember I couldn't get out of this pot bunker. And my ball was plugged. Let me plug my camera in, my computer in.
I want to see that. Pour ceux qui viennent de joindre nous, on est avec
my battery was going low. I forgot to plug my computer in. But I'm playing with all the great players. They're in their 40s, and I'm in my 20s. See, the kids today, they could really benefit from playing with all the great players from the era before. So, I watch the young kids, and I'm thinking, man, these guys are like child prodigies. And yet their technique can look like, you know, like an amateur almost. I mean, like even a Jason Day, as good as he is, he makes two double bogeys on the side of the green to win the TPC.
Yeah.
That's how good the guy is.
I know.
I don't ever remember anybody making two double bogeys with wedges in their hands, you know, with their chipper. I never saw Seve leave the chip short because he's afraid of going in the water. He's the left of, you know, 16 green, for instance, where he was. He chipped it short out of the high rough and then chipped it up. But, you know, he's got a real long, stiff takeaway. Kind of, it was just different. You know, Seve would have helped him with that, or Elkington, or somebody would have said, hey, look, this is how you do this. Greg Norman would have said, you can't do this.
Time has changed a little bit, and I got a great question about you. Were talking about the great players you played with. AJ McKenzie wants to know, what's one of your most memorable pairings in your time on tour, and what was so memorable about it?
The first time I played with Jack Nicklaus was at Troon in the British Open, like 1983 or 4. I think, 83. And I'll never forget it. He hit this beautiful one iron, like, wow, he cracked it. And it is the most beautiful shot I've ever seen with a one iron, high and long, and it kicks dead right. He looked at me, I said, wow. We walked down there side by side, and his ball's sitting in a big old divot. He can't hardly get it out. He just got to wedge it out. He said, Chip, that's British golf, isn't it? I said, wow. That didn't make sense. But on the second hole, I got in the bunker. I was so nervous playing with him because when I was a kid at 10 years old, he wasn't in the Ryder Cup. He was 27 years old. He'd won 7 tournaments and like 4 majors or something by the time he was 27. He'd won a bunch like Rory did.
Yep.
And he had to have he wasn't a member of the PGA of America. He had to have 5 years or whatever happens. He came to Fayetteville, and I followed him that day with Raymond Floyd, and it was like, that's what I want to do. So I get paired with him, my first British Open. And on the second hole, I blade my shot out of the bunker, the right side bunker, and bladed over the green, and I'm embarrassed. You know, I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't know if I've ever bladed a ball out of a bunker. It's been a long time. In front of Jack Nicklaus. So at that time I was taking some swings just to get a feel for the sand early in the day and what have you. Well, lo and behold, when I got in, the announcer, Nicklaus is sitting next to me, and the rules official came and said, Chip, are you aware that there were 1,000 calls that came in and said that you took a practice swing testing the soil on the second hole? And they said that was a wraparound bunker. It was the same bunker. Okay. I said, I wasn't. I said, Mr. Nicholas, did I do that? He said, yeah, you did. I said, give me two. And that was on a Saturday. And I, with a two-shot penalty, I missed the third day cut by two shots. Wow. But the nice thing about it, Nicholas never forgot me. And he started inviting me to his party down at Lost Tree and his pro-am. And I'm telling you, we became friends over that. And so that was really, he never forgot. You know, I think he felt so bad for me, but that's how nice he was. But I remember that pairing.
It's so amazing to being able to share some stories about Snead, about Nicholas, about those guys, to have that kind of history behind your career. Mark Fraser wants to know, Chip, what is your favorite golf course around the world?
Well, I mean, for tournament golf that we played was Pebble Beach. Because it required a lot, and it demanded a lot, and the weather always was a factor, and you had to understand where the ocean pool was. But what's interesting about Pebble Beach, and in my day, I've been around that corner 8, 9, and 10 where I've made double-double, and I'd be leading the tournament. And I'm telling you what, if you missed the fairway by 6 inches to the right, you were going to make bogey or double, just like that. In the younger generation, I don't know if it's the millennials, but when I was in 19, right around when I was leaving the tour, they started shaving those banks down because people said the course was too hard. I felt like the young kids didn't like tragedy. We were used to dealing with it because that was golf.
Yeah.
And what better place to have a tragedy than on the 18th hole of a major tournament, you know? And so that was just part of we were used to it, you know, and it was tough, but I don't think the kids liked that. They wanted every bounce, just perfect. Everything just, so you go to golf courses, they're perfectly manicured. You never get a funny bounce. It's like they even started, you know, even Payne Stewart was complaining about the ball getting in a divot. It was like a psychology of coming about that, it should be easier. It's like, oh man, this is crazy. I thought if they can't take tragedy, then life's going to be very difficult for them, you know?
But that what you're saying is interesting, because a big part of golf is tragedy, is not the plan that you had in your head, what you think you were going to do, what you think was going to happen, most of the time is not happening because of the wind, because of the conditions, because of everything. And that's the beauty of golf for me. And the greatest moments in golf happened in those kind of moments where something magical happens. Bubba coming out of the trees with his famous
shot. Wedge down there at Augusta. Yeah, that was something else.
Like the amount of shots you guys are able to put up and to think of that's what's beautiful about golf, because we look at the pros on TV. I'm a 6 handicap, 7 handicap. And I look at you. I'm a good golfer with my buddies. Always be my buddies when we play. But we look at you on TV and we're always wondering, how can they do that? Even if, like, the craziest shot or the baddest condition that you can have, you guys are going to get out of it. And that's what's crazy. And we're looking at the young players today. The older, everybody is good and so good with the clubs and the balls, and it's crazy to have that arsenal in your bag to always be able to come out of some shit and some bunk, right? And everything.
Like I was saying, you know, with Tiger Woods' 6-iron, it had to be the greatest 6-iron in the history of the game. And Phil Mickelson at Augusta, I didn't have that in my arsenal, hit that 6-iron from that rough from where he was. That was an amazing, a long shot. I remember when I went there in 1975, Bobby Nichols had driven the ball straight through past the trees, and he had a 6-iron in his hand. And he's a big guy. He'd won the PGA. And Bobby's a friend of mine. He lives right up the street here. And I watched him from 3 feet, and I saw him hit that 6-iron on that green about 10 feet from the flag. And I couldn't believe how far he hit it. And I'm telling you, that was 20 yards in front of where Mickelson hit that 6-iron, at least. And so I'm thinking, off the pine straw, and I grew up in North Carolina, we played off pine straw. That was an impressive shot, boy, from San Diego. Because for me, I can see it. I've hit drivers off pine straw. I've seen it, but wow, that's a very ticklish little shot. So there have been a lot of great shots in golf, and like the Nicklaus one iron. You think about that when he won at Pebble Beach. You see it on camera. It's like, wow. But the interesting thing is, like, our one irons, I remember when the Ping one iron came out in the early 80s, like 79, 80, 81, right when I was starting to tour. If it were 19 degrees, I couldn't get it off the ground. It would just go too low, and I couldn't hook it. It was dysfunctional. But now your three iron's 19 degrees, and the ball goes straight up in the air. So the perimeter weighting and then the spring in the face has really changed golf. That I think the spring in the face, by them allowing it in on the driver and not now the irons, it's changed the game of golf. And I don't think that's the best way to go. They should have, if they'd have just left the spring in the face out, the game would be a lot better. You won't make places like Marion and some of these courses obsolete.
Yeah, you know? Just before we let you go, I just want to talk a little bit about a Ryder Cup, because you've competed in three Ryder Cup, and for me, beside of the Masters, it's the most exciting golf event that you can have. The Ryder Cup this year is going to be at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin. They're talking about maybe Ryder Cup with no fans. Can it happen with no fans, you think?
I don't know how in the world you can have a Ryder Cup with no fans. I don't know how you have a golf tournament without fans. How does that make sense?
The
lure and the love of golf, and it's been that way since I saw Jack Nicklaus hit a fat wedge after he drove the corner, hit this powering drive over the corner of this dog leg, and left his wedge 60 feet short of the hole. And I'm thinking, I can do better than that. And I'm 10 years old. So when you can buy the same equipment that Arnold Palmer played, or Jack Nicklaus or Tiger Woods, and think, I can be as good as Tiger Woods, that's a big lure in golf.
I know.
So the fans make golf what it is today.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Anyway.
You played in three Ryder Cup, and I was looking at your credentials. The same year you entered a Ryder Cup, you were a rookie. The same year Freddie Couples was a rookie. And I was looking at the lineup. You guys were strong that year. It was crazy.
Yeah, people ask me, were you nervous playing the Ryder Cup? I'm thinking, are you kidding? I mean, I wasn't the top dog. The tournament rarely came down to me. I was having a great time. It was a social event. I was learning a lot. You'd find out what players thought about other players. You know, like Marco Mira, I'll never forget it. He said, Tom, he's talking to Tom Watson. He said, Tom, you intimidate me. I don't really play my best golf with you. I don't relax around you. It's like, so I prefer not to play with you. And I'm thinking, well, I'm nervous too playing with Tom Watson, but I think I'd be better off playing with him afterwards than not playing at all. So Tom and I played Seve, the Spanish Armada, and we got a half. So that was a big time for me to have that experience. But I'll never forget Raymond Floyd. Zinger and I, it was our first Ryder Cup in 89. And Floyd comes in there and says, Zinger and Beck, you guys have earned your way on the team. I'm putting you in. We'll play hard. We're counting on you. That was the greatest thing he could have done, because he knew that you're only as strong as your weakest link. That was amazing. But yeah, the Ryder Cup's a lot of fun. And Whistling Straits, one of the most intimidating golf courses to just walk and look at. It's not near as intimidating when you play it, but it, at least for me, it isn't. But it's a beautiful golf course right on Lake Michigan. So I want to tell you about another thing that has been happening. I've been working with the Canadian Fade, Derek Hiley. He's from like London, Ontario, and a great guy.
Okay.
And there's a company out of Boston that has this new app called Perfect Motion. Check it out.
I'll go for sure.
The Canadian Fade, Derek, is doing a great job with it, and I've really enjoyed meeting him. He's a great teacher, and I look forward to coming to Canada and seeing him and seeing my friends, the Ramones, and meeting you and playing some golf.
For sure. If we get to play one time together, I'll try to put up my best golf. I have a last question before I let you go, and I want to ask you this question because it's a great one. It's coming via Instagram, so I can't put it up on the screen, but Mario on Instagram wants to know, if you can build the perfect golfer from any time, any time frame, back then, today, contemporary golfer, what, like, drivers, iron play, chipping and putting, would it be like you take the drive from what player, iron play from what player, chipping from what player, and putting from what player to build the perfect golfer?
Well, you'd have to take the chipping and short game from Seve.
Yeah,
he's one of the greatest of all time, and I think bringing that 3-iron like he did, laying it down where it, you know, he didn't just slide the face open like a lot of the young kids today. They laid it and the handle dropped back so you'd widen your stance. That was a great thing he brought to the game of golf. And so, anyways, got to start there. I'd say you gotta go with, like, you know, Corey Pavin with the putter. I've never seen a better putter in my life. That guy could putt the eyes out of it. If you had a wind player with a long iron, you'd have to take Paul Azinger, you know, and then Tom Watson with the driver at the British Open. Could there be one any better? And another putter – like, I asked Nicholas, I said, Jack, did you ever three-putt the last green to win a tournament or to lose a tournament? He said, Chip, I might have, I probably done it, but I don't remember it. So Nicholas, under pressure, was the greatest golfer all around, and he would have risen to the occasion to play at Tiger Woods. There's no question about it. But Tiger Woods has got to be in that mix with, you know, from 200 yards – to 240 yards. He was the best player in the history of the game. And for 10 years, I mean, Jordan Spieth and Tiger Woods, they were putting as good as any two people I've ever seen. Jordan Spieth's one of the best putters I've ever seen.
Oh, he's
for
great.
10 years. So anyways, that's a fun thing to talk about, isn't it? There are so many people. They said George Knutson was a great iron player, one of the best all-time ball strikers. You always hear that about Knutson, and recently I saw a video of him watching Hogan practice. Well, that's pretty good, isn't it? So it was fun.
There are so many golf swings, so many great golf swings, golf irons players. There's a guy on the European Tour called Tapio Pulkkinen. He has a perfect golf swing, and every time I see him, I'm like, that's the beauty of the sport. You can have 1,000 types of golf swing, and they're still amazing, and the ball still goes to the same place and still goes to the green. That's why we love that sport so much. Chip, thank you.
One thing that, Max, that's really great about golf, there's always room at the top.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you're good, there will always be room for you at the top. That's the great thing about it. It doesn't matter when you get there either. And that's the fun of golf, trying to get to the top of the league. From the time I was a little kid, I was in my hometown just recently, and I said, Mom, how did I spend so much time at the golf course? For 50 years, I never thought about anything else but playing good golf.
It's crazy.
It's a great game.
And you did, and you had an amazing career, and it's been an honor for me to have you on the show this morning. Thank you so much, so, so much.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it, Max, and I look forward to getting up there and seeing all my Canadian friends. Have a great weekend.
They can't wait to have you, everybody. André Carole at La Tempête and everybody at La Table de Concertation. They're so excited to have you on. And David Skitt says hi. And
I love David Skitt, one of the great tournament directors of all time. He no stone is left unturned with David Skitt. He's great. I love the guy.
Chip, thank you so much. Hope you're well and safe, and hope we get to play golf soon.
We'll see you soon. Thank you so much, Max.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay. Je suis un peu ému. Puis je vais vous expliquer pourquoi. J'adore ce sport-là. Vraiment. C'est un sport qui me passionne, puis c'est un sport que je veux faire connaître. C'est un sport que j'arrête pas de dire à mes amis, à mes chums, à mon entourage, à quel point il y a des beaux moments alentour de ce sport-là, à quel point il se passe des affaires extraordinaires alentour du golf, à quel point c'est un sport qui te permet d'avoir des souvenirs exceptionnel. Autant quand tu joues avec ta famille, avec tes chums. Mes meilleurs moments de golf, c'est quand je les joue avec mon père, quand je joue avec ma blonde, quand je voyage avec mes chums, quand je les regarde à la télé. Quand Tiger gagne le Masters l'an passé, qu'on est tous à l'Expo Golf à Québec, puis que la vie arrête parce que ça, ça se passe. Puis ce matin, de pouvoir passer une heure avec un gars qui a gagné 4 tournois sur la PGA, qui a fini deuxième au Masters, qui nous raconte des anecdotes avec Sam Snead, avec Jack Nicklaus, qui nous parle de la Coupe Ryder. Je trouve que c'est un honneur quelque chose que j'ai comme ben de la misère à réaliser. Alors, merci à tous d'avoir été là. Merci à Normand Ménard. Merci à Mathieu Bouchard. Je vais vous mettre à l'écran quelques-uns. Merci d'avoir été là. Merci à Anne Rogerson. C'est trippant de faire ce show-là. C'est vraiment, mais vraiment un gros privilège que m'a fait la table de concertation en me confiant à ce mandat-là. Puis je les salue, Golf Québec, la PGA du Québec, l'Association nationale des propriétaires de terrains de golf du Canada, section Québec, l'Association des surintendants de golf du Québec, l'Association des clubs de golf du Québec. Merci à tout le monde d'avoir été là. Merci d'avoir posé des questions. C'était vraiment cool. C'était vraiment, vraiment cool. C'est un moment qui était incroyable. Fred Raymond, mon chum Fred à la tempête, merci d'avoir été là. Carole Bergeron également, merci. Écoutez, c'était cool, c'était vraiment le fun. J'en referai un demain, j'en ferai un à tous les matins. Mais là, ça se peut que je rentre dedans bientôt parce qu'il vente et il fait un petit peu froid comme ça à cette merveilleuse fin d'avril. Mais la bonne nouvelle, c'est qu'on va être de retour la semaine prochaine. On va être de retour samedi prochain et dimanche prochain à compter de 9h. On va vous annoncer les invités cette semaine. Vous allez savoir qui seront là cette semaine, mais assurément qu'on va avoir des professionnels du Québec, des jeunes espoirs du golf, des grands noms du golf. On va continuer de pousser la machine très longtemps. Tant qu'on n'aura pas mis les pieds sur le terrain de golf, on va venir la fin de semaine comme ça vous parler de golf puis générer une discussion. Merci d'avoir été là. Je l'apprécie tellement. C'était tellement cool comme moment. C'était tellement enrichissant. Merci à Chip Beck. David Skitt m'a dit « He's the nicest guy you will ever meet » puis il avait raison. C'est un gars qui est tellement généreux. C'était incroyable, les réponses, les anecdotes, tout ça. J'espère que vous avez aimé ça. Si vous avez raté l'épisode d'hier avec Johan Benson, Julien Trudeau, elle est déjà sur Spotify en version podcast. Si vous voulez l'écouter en courant, en faisant du vélo, peu importe, vous allez pouvoir y aller faire ça. Et je vais mettre celle-là en version podcast également dans les prochaines minutes. Vous allez pouvoir l'écouter en audio. Alors, merci à tous. Je vous souhaite un excellent dimanche. Merci d'avoir été là. C'était super cool. C'était une tasse de thé avec Max Lalonde, l'épisode numéro 2. Une initiative de la table de concertation de l'industrie du golf du Québec, une production de BAM Media. Merci à tous et on se retrouve samedi prochain, 9h. Salut.